Clerk will call the docket.
Edwin M. Ramos, et al. against Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., et al., Christopher E. Brown, Jessica M. Carter, Billy Cohen, Mary Catherine Zinsner, S. Wilson Reza, George A. Somerville, Stephen Elliott.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Lemons, Justices of the Supreme Court, my name is Christopher Brown. It's my pleasure to be here on behalf of the appellants, Mr. Ramos and Mrs. Gill. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if that would be all right with the Court.
All right.
This matter was a post-foreclosure breach of contract action challenging a sale conducted by the trustee following a default of the borrower. This was a VA loan, and as I argued during the writ petition argument, these lenders have this incredible power to take a family's home. It has been my position, and will continue to be my position, that this power may not be used for profit or gain. It is used to recover losses that the lender has suffered. These VA loans have special safeguards to ensure that that everything has been done to ensure that a loan does not go into default. And that was a very specific purpose, to protect taxpayer dollars. I suspect that is why this Court wrote such strong opinions in Matthews and Squires. The appellees quoted 24 CFR section 203.604B in their brief at page 4, where it states that the lender must have a face-to-face interview before the loan is 3 months in default and 30 days before foreclosure commences. This Court held in Matthews and Squires that a conditions precedent must be satisfied or the remedy of foreclosure does not accrue. This Court has repeatedly held in the past that this power is so great in a non-judicial forum where there is no court oversight, only one thing is asked of the lenders, and that is that they strictly comply with the terms of the deed of trust.
Counsel, may I ask you this? Your client's seeking rescission of the foreclosure sale contract, is that
yes.
right? The general proposition in equity is that only parties to the contract can ask a chancellor to rescind the contract. Assuming for the sake of argument that is the general rule, do you have authority for making an exception in your case?
Yes, I do, Your Honor. Thank you for the question. It's an issue that comes up all the time in the courts. Just as in Matthews, where the first breach principle didn't apply, it's a general contract principle that's accepted everywhere. But in these circumstances, where you have a deed of trust, which is a contract which governs the rights of the parties, and when this Court says that the power to foreclose, the trustee's power to foreclose, does not accrue, I don't have to be a party to that contract to rescind it. Assuming that I've kind of backed off my argument about the caveat emptor applies to a purchaser. I understand that they could be a bona fide purchaser in some circumstances. But I would ask this Court to recognize that under a deed of trust, if the power did not accrue and you buy what was sold to you at the auction and the trustee had nothing to sell, then you purchase nothing. Now, if it goes forward
for
value,
so a PMP without notice in the foreclosure sale, how would they ever know if their agreement is going to be enforced by the courts?
We can look at it two different ways. One, it can be that perspective. I have no notice, so you can't take the title back from me. Not the title was actually acquired in this case, and I'll address that later. Second, you could look at it this way, which is what a string of cases seem to suggest dating back to the 1800s. Caveat emptor applies to a purchase or foreclosure sale. You know you're buying at a sale, and you know there might be an issue that you're not aware of, because there are lots of things that can happen that won't be on the face of the document, the face of the advertisements, and buyer beware. If something comes up, you're on notice that you bought at a foreclosure sale, there could have been a problem, and it might be taken away from you. And in this instance, they made an argument that I don't have one of the elements of a claim of breach of contract, we didn't pay damages, and that they're a purchaser for value without notice. Well, they're not quite a purchaser for value because they haven't given value yet. They haven't gone to closing. It's quite a confusing issue, and this is one of those moments where I appreciated when Michael Smith was in my office. The gavel falls. The trustee holds legal title to the property. Legal title passes. Equitable title stays with the foreclosed borrower. They go to closing, they put a trustee's deed to record. And it's my understanding is that is when legal and equitable title emerged and the purchaser owns full title to the property. That has not occurred in this case. So I would ask this court to split the hairs and sort of say, well, the gavel has fallen, but the purchaser has not gone to closing, has not paid value, and has stepped back and said, I'm going to wait and see what happens. This is on the record. So that is notice. There might not be a list pendants in the land records, but they're conceding notice. They're not going to closing to see what happens, and this is what happens. The conditions precedent weren't satisfied, the remedy didn't accrue, and thus they didn't really take any title. So the trustee should be saying, I'm sorry, the memorandum of sale is void, as every memorandum of sale states, they have a right to do that. And the foreclosure should be unwound to the extent that there is a consummated foreclosure. Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, you're asking us to follow Matthews and Squire. Your opposing counsel has pointed out that there is a distinction between your case and Matthews and Squire, and that is vigilance. In Matthews and Squire, the party being foreclosed upon arguably exercised a greater level of vigilance before the foreclosure occurred. I wanted to give you the opportunity to speak to that issue.
I have 2 points in response to that. One, the lender seemed to get all the inferences at the demur stage in these foreclosure cases. And the demur standard seems to have been really clear. My client's entitled to the inferences. Two, if strict compliance with the deed of trust is required...
Your client is seeking an equitable remedy, though.
Yes.
And one of the equitable maxims is that equity will aid the vigilant.
Yes.
Explain how your client was vigilant.
The deed of trust requires strict compliance with its terms. And just as this court held in Matthews that the default of the borrower was irrelevant to enforcement of those conditions precedent, I would suggest that vigilance is irrelevant. Because then we get into these minute details that take away from this very basic principle that they must strictly comply with the trust document. In other words, if lenders are allowed to say, we don't have to follow those conditions precedent because we feel that people can't pay anyway, or we feel that people haven't been vigilant.
My question is not, did the lender breach its obligations?
Yes.
My question relates to the remedy that you were seeking. It's an equitable remedy.
It is.
Was your client vigilant?
Well, I believe the inference would be that my client was vigilant. It was not specifically pled. But I also feel that strict compliance with the deed of trust is required, just as how some principles go to the wayside because the deed of trust is a unique contract. Similarly, if they fail to satisfy the conditions precedent, whether or not my client was vigilant, or whether or not my client could cure if he had a face-to-face meeting, these things are irrelevant. Whether or not he was in default is irrelevant, as it was in Matthews. Because strict compliance is required, it's not about when we catch them on the few times I get before you. It's about all the times the borrowers aren't having this opportunity.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? This is, the count one is a breach of contract.
Correct.
How have you pled the elements of a breach of contract? How have you specifically pled that the breach caused any damage to your client?
Similarly to the point I just made, damages would normally be lost equity in the property, which is what Henry McLaughlin pled in the Squire's case. He didn't plead rescission on the breach of contract count, as the appellees seem to suggest, although they acknowledge it by a next sentence in their brief by saying, and he also tried breach of contract. But if strict compliance with the deed of trust is required, and there's a contractual term, a condition precedent that is not satisfied, if that means the remedy of foreclosure didn't accrue, this court didn't say, and it's equitable, and you were vigilant, and you could cure your loan. It means the remedy of foreclosure didn't occur.
Well, certainly in Squires there were many facts pled that indicated that but for the breach, she would have been able to she was damaged because of the breach. I don't see anything like that in your complaint.
Well, I would respectfully submit, one, I believe the inferences should be...
Tell me what inferences should be drawn.
That homeowners generally don't want to lose their homes. That the VA has these procedures in place to find a way for a family to move forward in their home and keep paying the loan to protect taxpayer dollars. There was nothing pled to suggest that they were ignoring notices or anything on the contrary. No plea and bar was filed to suggest that my clients were ignoring notices of sale or requests to do meetings or anything of that nature.
Shouldn't you at the minimum had to pled if we were given these meetings, would there have been a different result?
I would submit that respectfully, no. If strict compliance with the deed of trust is required. if the remedy of foreclosure does not accrue, if the conditions precedent aren't satisfied, they do not accrue. It doesn't matter if my clients can plead that some alternate outcome would have taken place. Strict compliance with these conditions present is required to protect the community from being abused by the economic disparity.
Your argument is that causation does not apply to your case. It applies to every other breach of contract case that we hear, but it doesn't apply to your case. What authority do you have for that?
Well, just as in Matthews, with this court held that the first breach principle didn't apply. That was a unique holding.
Okay, but that's not causation. It seems to me that Squire went out of its way to scrutinize the record to find a prima facie allegation of causation, and even then the court split 4-3. So my question to you is, what authority do you have that causation, which is typically an element of a breach of contract claim, is inapplicable to your case?
Well, in Taylor v. Rota, this court held that the lenders cannot ask for exemptions from the law. And foreclosure law in Virginia is established by Virginia Code 5559, and that code section says that the terms of the contract control. So essentially, Virginia foreclosure law is the terms of the contract. They want an exemption from the law that says you must satisfy these conditions precedent for the remedy foreclosure to approve. They should not be granted that exemption.
I don't think you're answering this question.
Well, what I'm saying is, given the nature of a deed of trust, if the condition precedent isn't satisfied and the remedy didn't accrue, it didn't accrue. We shouldn't have to get to whether or not an alternate outcome would have occurred. Because that gets into a minutiae of detail that will allow lenders going forward to say, well, all we have to do is go in and argue that no alternative outcome would have occurred, so we don't have to follow those conditions precedent. I don't believe that that's what this court wants to do. I would ask the court to stick with the requirement that there be strict compliance with the deed of trust, that all conditions precedent must be satisfied, and if they are not satisfied, the remedy doesn't accrue. I'll reserve the balance of my time.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Mohsen Reza, and I represent Appellee Wells Fargo Bank. I'm joined this morning by my co-counsel and colleague, Mr. George Somerville. Your Honors, we ask that the Supreme Court affirm the judgment of the Fairfax County Circuit Court because the appellants in this case, the plaintiffs, Mr. Ramos and Mrs. Gill, failed in their third attempt to plead state a cause of action for breach of contract. They also failed to state enough facts that would support, even with all inferences made in their favor, that they were entitled to any damages or the equitable remedy of rescission. I believe Your Honors have identified a critical issue in this case is the lack of any allegations about proximate cause of any damages that the plaintiffs may have suffered. There are absolutely no allegations that they suffered any damages because of the appellee, Wells Fargo Bank, failed to honor any obligation it had under the regulation, the HUD regulation, which required a face-to-face meeting. Without that, without the absolute element of damages and proximate cause, they cannot advance on a claim beyond a MERP. This is a case that's very different from Squire. In Squire, there were several allegations about the damages that were caused. Loss of equity, there's not that here. Out-of-pocket expenses, there's not that here. All we have are unspecified compensatory damages, which violates Rule 3:2C of Virginia Rules of Supreme Court, and an equitable claim for rescission, which is not supported by any of the facts.
How is this case different from Matthews? Assuming it's different from Squire, how is it different from Matthews?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Well, this case was brought post-sale. In Matthews, the court allowed the plaintiffs, the borrowers, to use the HUD regulation as a shield to prevent the foreclosure from going forward. That was appropriate in that situation. Rescission was not at issue at Matthews. Here, the plaintiffs, the borrowers, are asking the court to unwind the sale.
Breach of the contract, the note and deed of trust, was at issue at Matthews.
That's correct, but the difference is critical. The remedies sought were different. What you had, again, in Matthews was a situation where the borrowers came into court. They alleged that the lender there had an obligation to have a face-to-face meeting with them, and they didn't do that. And they, therefore, they could not accelerate and they could not foreclose. Here, what's happened is after the sale, the borrower came into court and said, please unwind this sale.
Because you're not asking us to limit in any way either Matthews or Squire. You're saying we, Matthews and Squire, do not need to be limited. This is simply something. This is a different animal. That's your position?
Your Honor, under Matthews and Squire, the court could find here that the dismissal of the Second Amendment complaint was correct. Because nothing that the plaintiffs have alleged in their Second Amendment complaint would even support a cause of action as the court in Matthews or Squire assessed the HUD regulation or a lender's obligation for loss mitigation under the HUD regulations. Matthews and Squire, I believe, correctly decided that the HUD regulation could be used as a shield prior to the sale, and post-sale, a borrower could come into court and allege damages for breach of contract. Here, what they've done is said, we're seeking rescission post-sale. We're going to seek damages, but we don't know what those damages are. I think that's a critical deficiency in their allegations. They haven't lost possession of the home in their allegation. What they've said is that there's a sale to a third-party purchaser that hasn't closed. They didn't plead that they lost their home. They didn't plead that they suffered any out-of-pocket expenses. All they've said is that there was a foreclosure sale that occurred. And that is simply not enough, Your Honor, for pleading the third element of a breach of contract claim, damages. They didn't plead proximate cause, and they didn't actually even plead damages. And I think it was important because they were on notice from the prior demurrers in this case that that was a problem. They were on notice in every demurrer in this case that they didn't give a specific amount of damages, for example. Where Squire, the borrower's counsel, gave it to the penny. So I don't believe that, even assuming, Your Honor, that every inference was given to them, that they had pled an obligation that existed and that the lender breached that obligation, they still need to plead the existence of damage and proximate cause, which is an important issue and is an issue that was highlighted by Justice Kinzer in her partial dissent in Squire.
Counselor, can I ask you a different, move along a little bit. Assuming just for the sake of this argument that they properly pled causation, and we now get to the issue of what do we do at this point in time. Can you have a rescission in a situation like this without the borrowers being in a position to put things back where they were in the beginning? How do you proceed in a case like this?
Your Honor, that's a great question because we had asked the court to say that a borrower must show the ability to put the parties back to the status quo. If the court were to unwind the foreclosure sale, if the court were to rescind the contract between the trustee and the third-party purchaser, there needs to be some pleading that they have the ability to correct the problem, to satisfy any arrearage that may be on the loan.
And we're not talking about proof. We're just talking about a pleading at this point, right?
Right. And they haven't alleged that. And this is similar to the problem that's at issue in a lot of cases involving the right to rescinder under the Truth in Lending Act, for example. If a borrower can't plead tender, whether in the total amount or substantially, which the court has said in recent cases, then they can't advance on their claim for rescission. Here all we have is a borrower asking the court to look at this HUD regulation and impugn strict liability. Regardless of whether damages were suffered, regardless of whether any proximate cause.
Counsel, as I understand the facts of this case, the sale has not closed. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so this is not exactly Matthews, because in Matthews, I believe the sale had closed, and we implied that pre-sale rescission might be appropriate, post-sale rescission probably is not, but this is sort of a note. This is the middle ground. And so, what is your argument that rescission can't be undone? It hasn't been sold.
Well, Your Honor, I would differ in my view from what the plaintiffs say about the status of the sale. The sale is complete when the gavel falls. When the gavel falls, legal title is in the trustee. It still remains in the trustee. The equitable title is passed. there is value that was given. There's a deposit that every purchaser at a foreclosure sale pays. That is not pled, but that's routine. In every memorandum of sale, there is a deposit. Otherwise, how would the trustee know that this party would be a bona fide purchaser or is a bona fide purchaser? If they are a bona fide purchaser for value, the sale did close under Virginia law, because once the trustee accepts the bid, the legal title that the trustee has still remains, but the only thing that's left to be done is simply recording the trustee's deed and completing the sale with the remaining purchase price. So it's an interesting posture, Your Honor. I understand, because in Matthews we had a pre-foreclosure posture. In Squire it was post-foreclosure, post-closing. Here we've got post-foreclosure sale, pre-closing, but that doesn't change the analysis. There's a third-party purchaser here who was a purchaser, a bona fide purchaser, who had no notice that there was any problem with
this property. Is that party a party to this litigation?
The third-party purchaser? Yes, Your Honor. They are a party. They were eventually made a party because we argued in prior to MERS that they were a necessary party.
And is there any assertion that the buyer at the foreclosure sale was not, in fact, a BFP without notice?
I think the borrowers would contend that, but there's nothing in the record that would establish that. There is a difference, Your Honor, between caveat emptor, which is a principle that's really used in this situation for the status of the property itself. You're buying the property as is. Caveat emptor applies, versus whether a buyer is a bona fide purchaser. Unlike Squire, or in Squire, I should say, the court said that the buyer was a third-party purchaser, a bona fide purchaser. Here, this was a litigation that was filed post-sale. No allegation that there was a list pendants recorded. No allegation, like, for example, in Matthews, where the plaintiffs alleged that they told the prospective purchaser that this property was in litigation. So there's nothing in the record that would establish that this third-party purchaser or defendant in this action was anything but a bona fide purchaser for value. So, Your Honor, again, they've not pled facts to support a claim for rescission or the remedy for rescission under a breach of contract. Your Honor pointed out vigilance was extremely critical, and it always is. And
you might not want to go too far down that path. Your client wasn't particularly vigilant either. All they had to do was read their own document.
Well, Your Honor, I do want to say, though, that we, as we put in a footnote, we disagree with what they pled about loss mitigation that was offered. I think you can infer from their prior complaint that they knew, let's say, as late as October of the prior year that the loan was in default.
I'll infer that somebody from Wells Fargo Bank should have read the document and done what the document said, and if they had done so, we wouldn't all be here today.
Well,
I understand that the moving party has to be vigilant, but you might want to just move on into your next argument.
Sure, and absolutely, Your Honor, but I do want to make clear that we disagree with the allegations, although we understand under MERS that the court has to take what the plaintiff has pled. Your Honor, there simply is an proximate cause. Every breach of contract claim in Virginia requires the allegations that there were damages, that there was proximate cause that connected the breach of the obligation to the damages suffered. All you have here, Your Honor, is an allegation that the foreclosure sale occurred. That's simply not enough. They cannot ask the court, or they cannot treat this breach of contract claim any different than every other breach of contract claim would be treated by Virginia law. You've got to have every single element. They failed to do that. They failed to state that they had proximate cause, and they failed to state enough facts to support a claim for rescission, whether it's a remedy under a breach of contract or it's an independent cause of action or remedy that could be read in their complaint. So for those reasons, Your Honor, I believe that the Circuit Court was correct in sustaining the demurrer on the third and the second amended complaint. The plaintiffs had failed to state a claim under breach of contract. They failed to state that they suffered any damages for any alleged failure to follow the HUD regulations. And we ask that the court affirm the judgment below.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to first address the issue of authority. And I think it would come from the contract itself. Just as the liquidated damages provisions can sort of forego an element of a breach of contract claim, this contract puts aside proximate cause, damages, and says these conditions precedent must be satisfied. If they aren't satisfied, the remedy of foreclosure did not accrue.
Well, see, that works in Matthews because you file an injunction before the foreclosure takes place. But how does it work here when you're asking for a breach of contract?
Yes, Your Honor, it's going to be my very next point. It gets us to the issue of the BFP. Now, are they a bona fide person? And I didn't cite this case in my brief. I am so sorry. There is specific case law from this court that says the purchaser has to specifically plead that they were a bona fide purchaser to be granted that status. And they did not do that. And I don't believe they are a bona fide purchaser. If we're going to make inferences from memorandum of sale in that they all take a deposit,
the
they
problem
all
is
also
not the, their yes. status or lack of status as a BFP. The problem is the case law says, unbroken case law says, that you have to be a party to a contract in order to seek rescission. You don't even inquire what the status of the parties are in that analysis. These HUD regs, as you pointed out, have been interpreted by dozens and dozens of appellate court cases across the nation. My question is very narrow. Is there authority, legal authority, for your proposition, which is post-foreclosure sale, a court can rescind a contract which the mortgagor was not, in fact, a party to?
Not where the purchaser is a bona fide purchaser for value. I cannot argue that. What I can argue is where you are not a bona fide purchaser for value, the court can rescind it.
Well, is there authority for that? That even though your client was not a party to the contract that he seeks to rescind, if your non-party to the contract can assert that the buyer to the foreclosure sale is not a BFP without notice, then you can violate the general maxim, which is you have to be a contractual party. Is there legal authority for that proposition?
Well, respectfully, I believe that's why we have the entire principle of bona fide purchaser.
Well, I'm only asking for if you have cites so that we can read them and understand how a court would consider this problem.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have any cites, but what I can say is I think it's very clear in this court's case law that if you're not a bona fide purchaser, the title can be taken back from you. That's not a new principle. I don't even think that the appellees deny that. And I don't believe they are a bona fide purchaser. We're going to take inferences from memorandum of sale. That memorandum of sale says, we, the trustee, may give you your deposit back and take back title for any reason, and you can't say anything about it. And that's essentially notice that there might be a problem and you might lose your title. Now, the gavel fell. It's not for value. They haven't gone to closing. They don't have a trustee's deed. So we do have a unique situation. As I said, I've backed off of the caveat emptor applies to a purchaser foreclosure sale. If they're a bona fide purchaser without notice, that's going to be an uphill battle for me to argue. What I can argue is they haven't paid value, and they're not really a bona fide purchaser because the memorandum of sale, as is well understood, says if an issue comes up, we're going to give you back your deposit and we're going to take back this title and there's nothing you can say about it. With respect to the issue between rescission or damages, I can't get both. So I don't think it's a violation of the Supreme Court rules that I didn't plead my damages to specificity. In truth, there aren't going to be any damages if there's no equity in the property. But what that would mean is that every homeowner that's underwater, a lender's going to say, we don't have to follow any conditions precedent because they're not going to have any damages. They're not going to be able to challenge us on this sale. And I don't think that's correct.
All right, your time has expired. Call the next case.